So last week, I'm in the middle of this series on doing some just sort of an expository work on First Peter, and you know, because of the various things that happened throughout the year, I suspend that and then spend time on other things. So we did that for the Easter season, and then we entered into like Memorial Day, and so I wanted to spend some time on Memorial Day, and just to ask the question: what is the biblical view of how we observe something like Memorial Day? And it's interesting to me, as I was thinking about this, that you know, you think of Memorial Day, and then by extension, patriotism. You really can't divorce those two things away from each other. If you're going to celebrate Memorial Day, then you are celebrating to some degree the fact that you are a patriot. And so what is the Christian view of that? And as I was thinking about that more, the thought occurred to me that that really is just one of the big questions of our time. It was never a question for most of our nation's history, but it certainly is a question of our time. And I've had people question me about that over the years, about my view, my participation in something called patriotism as it relates to Memorial Day or July 4th or whatever. And so it seemed to me that if God gifts us with living in a nation like this, and it is a gift, then it's certainly appropriate to love the gift that He has given to us, and then to use that gift in some way on a regular basis to advance the kingdom of God. So it is okay, it's more than appropriate to love the country in which you've been born, and to love the sacrifices that the people make to ensure that the good things that that country is about endure. That's all very appropriate. And I suppose, again, on this side of either ocean, it's easy for us to not see what other people have to endure, or to not see what this country has played a primary role in many times, and how the people of the world have benefited from our sacrifices. It is true that we have done some things that we should not have done, and that people suffered as a result of that as well. And that should never be hidden or closeted or anything like that. But over the arch of history, because of the Judeo-Christian worldview that has dominated this country for its well over 250 years, the benefits that have come from that for us and for others have far outweighed the negatives. And I think it's perfectly okay to celebrate that. So that's us, that's me in terms of the secular world, but that's also a significant question in terms of the church. So not a lot, but over the years I have been criticized by some people because of my love for this country and the gift that it is and the benefits that it has shared and the potential that it possesses. And so for them, it's an all or nothing thing. It's only the citizenship of heaven and not the citizenship of earth. Which, by the way, I just want to say to you that the Jews in the Old Testament would have found that to be very curious. I mean, and they lived under a theocracy. They lived under a theocracy, so they loved their God and they loved their country. And even had some laws, fairly significant laws in place to ensure the preservation of that country, because at least initially, as Israel was called, they were called to be a light to the nations. And so as they preserved that, that culture, that theology, that ideology that they possessed, and it meant that they could continue on being a light to the nations when they were obedient. If we preserve the Judeo-Christian worldview and framework that was part of the inception of our nation, then there are blessings that flow from that, not only to us, but to other people within the world as well, as citizens of this country. So those are just, I thought then that because these questions are so huge that I wanted to finish what I started last Sunday. And so let me just ask this question, because I've talked with a number of you since then. I want you to feel free to raise your hand and ask some questions, because I think this teaching is very important. And I think the nuances are crucial. So anybody here have any questions from last Sunday that you might like to ask, or a comment you might like to make? Or if while I'm, yes?
You made a comment last week that for us to go to war as a country and as individuals,
yes,
it has to be a just war.
Yes, just cause, yep.
During the Civil War, we had Christians in the North fighting, Christians in the South fighting. During the Second World War,
yeah.
Who were Christians.
Yeah.
We would look at that as Americans and say that was unjust. As a nation, we would say that the southern states who succeeded, that was unjust. How do we reconcile those Christians who defended the southern states and defended Germany?
Well, I have 45 minutes. No, that's okay. So let me just say, Jim's asking a very good, and that's, again, why this is so important to teach on and for you to have a perspective about. So let's take the Civil War for just a moment. There are many Christians in the South who were not fighting necessarily because of for the preservation of slaves, but they were fighting over the principle of the republic. In other words, states' rights. So we are a democratic republic. Okay? So in other words, to put it in a very kind of crude way, we're supposed to be 50 kind of miniature nations that have come together as a group of nations that concede a limited amount of things that brings us together, but after that, we get to decide. Each state has its own autonomy. So there were Christians who in the South who went to war over that issue. And so whether that was just or not can be debated, but I'm raising that issue because none of these wars that Jim mentioned have a simple either-or kind of thing. It's never just this or just that. It's an amalgamation of a bunch of stuff that's all gnarled together, you know. So, but per, I think the point that he was really making was that how could Christians in the South fight on behalf of slavery, the preservation of slavery, on the one hand, and Christians in the North fight, for the abolition of slaves, on the other hand. How do those Christians in the South explain themselves? So that in and of itself alone is way more than 45 minutes, but I will say that's the problem when Christians become too much a people of this world, too enculturated by where they live and how they've been raised, and lose the ability to think outside of the world in which they find themselves. So I would suspect that the Christians in the South were deeply enculturated. So, for example, the Hamite myth. Are you familiar with the Hamite myth? So, when Noah got on the boat and sailed for 40 days and 40 nights, and then he found some land and got off the boat, and he fell asleep in the sun. And his son, Ham, saw him naked. And he made fun of his father to his other brothers. And Noah woke up and overheard the conversation. And he cursed Ham, who happened to be of darker skin. He cursed Ham and all of the descendants of Ham. And so Christians in the South argued that people of African descent were descendants of Ham. And the fact that they were enslaved and in bondage was a part of God's preordained curse upon their lives. That's horrible, okay? Biblical exegesis, right? But if you were raised in the South and you didn't have much of an education and that kind of thinking permeated the way in which you've been raised, it could be a struggle or a challenge for you to get outside of that, because unlike today, pastors, by and large, were phenomenally well more educated than their local congregants. So you just automatically listen to what they had to say. So I would say that would be one of the explanations. Now in Germany, don't forget that there, you know, so here, I don't know if you know this, but many churches in Europe are supported by state dollars. The government pays to have the church operate. It's not necessarily through tithes and offerings. The government. So in Germany, the government paid for the church, right? And so one of the most unbelievable examples in Germany was a guy named Kittel. Kittel was a scholar who developed what is still considered to be today the authority on the Greek dictionary and lexicon, the English-Greek dictionary and lexicon. In other words, if you go to a seminary and you want to say, what does this really say in the Greek? If you want the authority, you go to Kittel. And there's a thing called Little Kittel and Big Kittel. And Little Kittel's about this big and Big Kittel's about this big. Okay, it is exhaustive, right? Kittel went to church regularly, had nightly devotions with his children and family, was a scholar, and I forget what university he was at, but Kittel entered into a relationship with a group of other German theologians who spent their downtime trying to figure out how to de-Judaize Jesus. In other words, they worship Jesus, but they try to figure out how to make the argument that he really wasn't a Jew so they could still do the things they wanted to the Jews. Did you know this? All right, so it raised some questions. How could you be that well educated? I mean, Germany at the time in the early 1930s, despite what happened to them in World War I, Germany was the intellectual, the cultural, the educational, the religion, the theological center of the world. Germany was considered to be, England might have contested with them a bit, Great Britain. The United States was still an up-and-comer at the time. But Germany was considered to be on the forefront of all of that stuff. In 1930, 1932, 1933, and if you'd said to a German soldier at the a German civilian at the time, guess what? In about 8 or 10 years, you, this country, is going to do these things to all of these people in all of these horrible ways. And they would have said, that's impossible. We are the most well-educated. We are the best enculturated. We have the finest theological schools in the world. That would be impossible. We are simply too civilized to have ever done, to ever do anything like that. So if some people wonder why there are weapons of war in a civilized society, Germany is the premier example. So you had in Germany what was called the confessional movement. When people began to see what the leadership in Germany was doing, when churches began to fold because they didn't want to lose the government dollars, then you had this confessional movement that broke away from the German church and lived in rebellion to the direction of the German government and the German Lutheran Church at the time. So there was some pushback by a number of people. Karl Barth would have been one of them. Bonhoeffer was the classic example. People like that. Who's that? Niemöller. Yeah, Niemöller had that fascinating quote. First they came for the communists, first they came, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I don't remember it exactly, but it's a great quote. So here's the thing. This is why Christians must first see themselves as citizens of heaven, which is what my first primary point was last week. There can't be any confusion that we are first citizens of heaven, then citizens for whatever country or nation we belong to on earth. And it's the fact that we are citizens of heaven that informs us how to be a citizen on earth. It's not, so the people in the South then probably were too much citizens on earth, and they allowed their citizenship of the South to define how they should be a citizen of heaven when it came to people of African descent. That's why it's very important that everybody here study and why you should know, because look, the enemy is all about confusion. He's all about obfuscation so that you can't tease out what the real issues are. That's why we have to hunger for wisdom and knowledge. And if we can't read it, then we listen. If we can't listen, then we have conversation. Because when we're confused, and the enemy capitalizes on that confusion, and then during times of testing like this, then Christians get sucked in, and then we get blamed. So, that would be, some of you others may have some other things you might want to add, but, and maybe, I mean, if you wanted to, we could have a, you know, we could have a, do something this summer where we can talk about that kind of stuff and unpack it. But I want to try and get to, and I the rest of what I have here for you this morning, and I'm going to shoot through some of this faster than what I was going to, because I wanted to take the time to answer Jim's question appropriately. So the first thing I talked about last week was the issue of citizenship and fidelity, and the fact that we have to be citizens of heaven first, and that's what informs us about how to be the best possible citizen here on earth. And probably the primary text for that is Philippians 3. But our citizenship is in heaven. We eagerly await a Savior from there, the Lord Jesus Christ, who by the power that enables him is subject to all things to himself. So as a citizen, everything that belongs to Christ, we are subject to in that regard. The Apostle Paul talks to us about how we are ambassadors for Christ. So if you are an ambassador, you are a citizen, but you're not only a citizen, you are also an official citizen. You occupy a particular office where you represent that country in a very specific and a very powerful way. So I would say, you know, that would probably be the primary text. The second thing that we talked about, what does the conduct of citizens of heaven look like? And I referred to you Romans 12, verses 14 through 21, but I'm going to back it up to verse 12 through 21, and I'm just going to go through some of this and make some comments because I just think this is such a powerful text, and I just want to spend a few moments on it. And I hope that maybe some of you had a chance this past week to reread it, to go over it and review it. This would be a central text for what should inform us about how to be a citizen of heaven while still at the same time being a citizen on earth. So that's why this text is so very important. So it's Romans 12. And by the way, I'm using this term en pneumo because what that means as a principle of, as a matter of principle, all of this is absolutely true. But en pneumo always leaves it open for, like, there are exceptions. There may be some exceptions, and I'm going to try and get to that later on in the text. So we begin with verse 12, where the apostle Paul says, now, you know, again, Paul's in bondage here. A lot of bad stuff has happened to him. He's coming up on the conclusion of the book of Romans, that great theological work of his. Probably the most influential book in the New Testament is the book of Romans, aside from the Gospels. So he's rounding up to a conclusion here in chapter 12. And so verse 12, he says, rejoice in hope. In other words, let your hope that you have cause you joy. You ever think of it that way? Let the hope that you have cause you joy. Be patient in tribulation. That word tribulation is hoop om eno, which means to endure, to remain, and to abide. So abide in tribulation, remain faithful, endure tribulation, and be constant in prayer. So in personal matters of the heart and character, the Apostle Paul begins this segment with rejoice in hope. Let your hope cause you joy. And if you don't have hope, you're not going to have joy. Be patient in tribulation. Be constant in prayer. That word constant means to be devoted, to be committed. So be devoted to prayer as Christians in the world in which we live. So that's what he starts with when it comes to our character and our heart. Verse 13, contribute, which means to partner or share, to the needs of the saints and to seek to show hospitality. So that word seek means to pursue or press forward. You are looking for opportunities to practice hospitality. Now, the interesting word about this hospitality, it's a Greek word, philonexia. It's not a gasoline station. That's the real word. Philonexia. And that Greek word means this: lover of strangers. So pursue hospitality. Pursue ways to love strangers. That's not us. That's really not our culture, you know. We're more, what you would say, xenophobic. Xenophobic means the fear of strangers. And it all begins in grade school, stranger danger, all that kind of stuff, right? So this is a compelling text. that we should. He's addressing the two kinds of people that are in our lives, right? Contribute, partner, share in the needs of the saints, partner with them, and seek to show hospitality, seek to find ways to love the stranger, people that you know, people who are the saints, and people who are not the saints. Verse 14, bless those who persecute you, bless and do not curse them. That word curse is katarnom ahi, which means doom. And we all do this. Well, I hope he gets what he wants. I hope he chokes on it. We've all done that. We've all said those kinds of things. Right? Well, when somebody angers you or is your enemy, or they persecute you because of your faith, bless them. Bless and do not curse. This is a tough teaching. These are hard things. I mean, this is among, I think, Paul's most challenging teaching that he has as a composite in all of his writings, in all of his epistles. Verse 13. Verse 13. 15. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Weep with those who weep. So, bless, don't curse. And then he moves over to another kind of application where he says, rejoice with those who rejoice, weep with those who weep. So, as believers, we live in this world where he wants us to sympathize and to empathize with people. So if somebody's rejoicing and they are happy about a good thing that takes place in their life, rejoice with them. And if they have been grieved by something in their life, sympathize. And if you can, empathize. There's a difference between the two. Sympathy means that you feel badly for somebody. Empathy means you know what they feel like. And you can convey to them because you know what it feels like. If a woman has had a miscarriage and a friend of hers has a miscarriage, she can empathize with that woman for the loss that has taken place. To sympathize means you just put yourself kind of like, well, I think this is how I would feel. I mean, that sounds terrible. I would never want to go through that. All of us have great sympathy for those parents in Uvalde. None of us can empathize, but we can all sympathize with those parents in Uvalde. Excuse me. Verse 16. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be haughty. So there's this play on words here, harmony, haughty. So if you live in harmony, you are living as one. Do not be haughty, which means that you have an overly inflated view of yourself. So if you live in harmony with each other, then you probably have, in a good way, an overly inflated view of the other person. To be haughty means that you have an overly inflated view of yourself, your ability, your opinions, things like that. But rather, associate with the lowly. So not only tolerate them, sorry, do not be haughty, but rather associate with the lowly. Never be wise in your own sight. I ran across a meme earlier that's not in my notes now, so I must have failed to include it. So then the Apostle Paul goes on to say, in matters of how we are to be in the treatment of others. How we are to be in the treatment of others. Verse 16, I'm sorry, that's live in harmony with each other. Do not be haughty, but rather associate with the lowly. Never be wise in your own sight. And then this is the meme I ran across, which I love. Man is wise only while in search of wisdom. When he imagines he has attained it, he is a fool. I should say man. Man is wise only while in search of wisdom. So this, you know, connecting to this last text that Paul writes about pursuing wisdom, that's a person, when a person believes they have arrived in their wisdom, that's a person who is haughty. They know it all. They can't be taught. They have no teachable spirit. Verse 17, repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all. Repay no one evil for evil. I mean, if we just took our imaginations of how we have fantasized of repaying evil to somebody who did evil to us. Maybe we didn't really do it, but we didn't act it out, but we thought, boy, if I had this chance, this is what I would do. And we would give it to them, right? And so he's saying, repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all. 18, if possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. If possible, so far as it, because you can't always control what other people do. But our goal is to live as peaceably with people as we possibly can. That is the matter of principle. Live peaceably with all. So then he goes on to say more specifically about how we should treat those who are our enemies. Where he says, 19, beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. There are so many people in this world who are paralyzed with the thought that somebody who did them wrong will get away with it. I had a family member who inherited a house. And in order for him to get that house, they had to go through a lawyer. And by the time the lawyer got done doing all of the paperwork and the extension, stuff like that, there was nothing left. And it drove my family member crazy that this lawyer walked away with tens upon tens upon tens of thousands of dollars. And that there would be no justice for him. But it says here, beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. And it's the Lord who exhibits justice in an equitable manner. Because in most cases, if we have been dealt with unjustly, not always, but a lot of times, we contributed to how we were dealt unjustly. In other words, we may think that it's all them and none of us, but it's because it's the Lord who can judge, who can divide between the bone and the marrow, that we are held accountable for any way in which we contributed to how somebody treated us unjustly. And that happens too much. Verse 20, to the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he, your enemy, is thirsty, give him something to drink. For by doing so, you will heap burning coals on his head. And so this is a matter of principle. This is how we treat those people who consider ourselves to be our enemies. This is a hard teaching. Verse 21, do not allow yourselves to become overcome by evil, but you must instead overcome evil with good. I'm so sorry. Falling from the trees has been driving me crazy this week, so I have some water here. So in conclusion, this is a very high bar set by the Apostle Paul for all of us. And this bar is something that we need to embrace and employ regardless of the circumstances that go on in our life. But if Christians and Christian leaders live by these principles, the prospect of violence and need for it, the war diminish. But taking all of this aside, as I've worked through this passage from the Apostle Paul, which I think is a compelling passage and a very important passage for the citizen of heaven to live by, how does all this comport with self-defense, with the defense of others, and with war? How do we take what the Apostle Paul just said here, and how do we comport it with self-defense? If you can go on to the next slide there, and the defense of others. In other words, does this mean I'm never allowed to defend myself based on what the Apostle Paul said? If some person wanted to assault me or murder me, or if a person wanted to torture me, do I just give in? Is it okay for them to do that? Or somebody you know and love, is that okay? Are we to defend those people that cannot help themselves, that are helpless? Or do we allow the evil person to just do whatever they want to do? And if that's, and if they're not allowed, if it's okay for us to defend ourselves and others, or our country and the people, what would be the biblical basis? What would be the biblical principles that we would live by in accordance to that? And so that's why I say that Romans 12:12 through 21 is practiced and pneumo. As a matter of principle, these things are always true, but there are exceptions to which they may not be true. And so we have to, I think, explore that. So there are two Christian traditions regarding war or violence. One is pacifism, and the other is a thing called just war theory. Pacifism has always been a subset within the history of the church, as has just war theory, but it particularly was articulated through a guy named Augustine. And it's been Augustine's teaching on just war theory that has guided Western civilization for about 1,600 years. So it was not only Augustine, but also Aquinas. Aquinas picked it up and developed Augustine's thought a bit more. The biblical argument for pacifism comes primarily, and this is my opinion, but the biblical argument for pacifism comes primarily through the use of eisegesis. That is to say, a select, where you take certain texts that are very select, often devoid of their context, to make a larger point that simply should not be made in light of the whole of Scripture. That's eisegesis. But the biblical argument for just war theory comes primarily through the use of exegesis, where you look at the whole of Scripture, the whole of the context. And I would want to say that even with that, we have to be very careful how often and in what way we would ever, ever use violence or just war theory in the world in which we live. So here's a question. Is it justifiable to go to war? Is it justifiable to violently defend oneself, those whom we love, or the defenseless, or for the preservation of one's nation and culture, especially if the nation being attacked is a better force for good? And if so, what are the criteria? This is hotly debated in the world of higher education. It's hotly debated among the elites within the culture in which we live. I'm always a little bit amused that many of the people who debate these are never in situations where they have to worry about it. Many of them live in gated or double-gated communities,
Hollywood,
or they live in these bubbles where the possibility of these things is never an ever-present reality. Pacifism says this: violence only begets still more violence. Violence exists not because of evil, but because of injustice, a lack of education and economic opportunity, and I would say oppression. Being willing to suffer in the face of evil personally and to call others to do the same. So pacifism basically says, look, if somebody's being violent, a violent response only begets still more violence. And it just cycles on. And so so the solution, the real answer is to just be a pacifist, to not respond to violence. Now, I think there are some cases in which that is absolutely true. I think that the civil rights movement of the 1960s was largely successful because of its pacifist approach to the unjustness that they experienced. But I think that it's probably not a one thing that fits all. I will say this. I'm always a bit stunned by the resolute pacifists who in naive fashion are willing to risk, subject, and sacrifice multitudes of uninvolved and relatively innocent people to a myriad of exquisite horrors. In other words, you have to be a pacifist. Yeah, but they're doing all these horrible things. I know they are, but still, you can't respond. You cannot be violent. You cannot. Yeah, but they're like torturing. They're doing horrible things to me and my children. That I know they are, but you cannot respond violently. And so what they end up doing is they end up defending the pathological evil person or people more than they defend the people who are being subjected to the evil or pathological person. They almost sometimes present it as if the evil pathological person is more virtuous than the people who are tempted to respond by defending themselves. I kid you not. So if a person believes that they are called to be pacifists, that's fine, but never assume this to be the value for those who did not ask for the pacifist to be a diplomat on their behalf. The pursuit of peace in the spirit of pacifism has its many necessary applications. But as an absolute thing, it is neither biblical nor practical as an all-encompassing solution. That's my opinion. Well, some people would say, well, Jesus was a pacifist. Well, that's highly debatable. Jesus said, I am coming with a sword. Jesus is one of the ones that throws Satan into a fiery lake. That's not particularly a pacifist position, I think. But because some people do believe that Jesus was a pacifist, there are many denominations that are pacifist denominations. The Anabaptists, like the Mennonites, Quakers, and Amish, and Jehovah's Witnesses, the Moravian Church, the Seventh-day Adventists are all pacifists. And who was the soldier in the South Pacific that saved all of those soldiers? He was a Seventh-day Adventist. What was his name?
Desmond Doss.
Now, I will say to you that if you ever, and I would recommend that you see it, if you can handle that kind of stuff, but I would recommend that you see it. That was an inspiring film of a person who exercised their pacifism in such a way that they saved, how many soldiers did he save? How many?
75
soldiers that he saved by himself. as a pacifist.
The movie's name is Hacksaw.
Hacksaw Ridge, yeah. So a powerful film. And that, so there was some application there that was deeply moving. And a person who stood by his principles in that way. He didn't say, for example, that we shouldn't be fighting this war. He just said, I don't feel called to be a soldier in that kind of a way. So I will do something else. And what he did at Hacksaw Ridge was unbelievable and truly inspiring. Sometimes when we think about denominations, and this is a parenthetical statement, and I'm not going to get through all of this because I'm trying to treat it as comprehensively as I can. So, but I want you to understand this. when a group of people or a historic church leader says the best possible way to know God is through this particular attribute. So Quakers and Mennonites and Seventh-day Adventists and Jehovah's Witnesses believe that Jesus was a pacifist, that he was all about peace. And only, really, that's his primary thing. Jesus was primarily about peace. When we describe God in that way and then develop an entire theological system and an entire ecclesiastical system based on that one view, then you have this little monocle like this. And you look through that monocle, and that's how you see God. And that's how you see everything else that follows. So because God is primarily about peace, then this is the kind of church we're going to be. This is going to be our primary theology. This is how we're going to do our theological praxis, how we work out our theology, only through this lens. But the truth of the matter is, God is like a multifaceted diamond. A monocle has one lens. A perfect diamond has a whole bunch of lenses. And so I want you to picture a perfect, beautiful diamond, all with lenses that are equal size, and then try to grasp the fullness and the beauty of that diamond in that kind of a way. And that facet, each facet in that diamond represents an attribute of God. He's about peace. He's about justice. He's about love. He's about holiness and a whole bunch more. That's what should inform our theology. So when we take God and we view him only through a monocled lens, then we can't come up with the right kind of important nuances and oftentimes exceptions about how he wants us to live our life. So that would be my critique of pacifism among Christians, that you limit God by seeing only this one part of him and saying, therefore, that's how we must see everything else. Because in many Reform circles, they see a God who is about justice. And when there's injustice, then there must be some kind of recompense, or there must be some way to stop the injustice. And so that launches a whole different kind of conversation. So let me conclude this portion then by saying that in response to all of to much of that, there is a thing called just war theory. And you know what I'm going to do? I'm just going to take a few minutes. I'm going to skip over some stuff. And I just want you to understand what it is, and then maybe someday we can unpack it a bit more. I'm only going to do this for a moment or two, just so that you can see what it is. In just war theory, in other words, let me just say this. If as a pacifist you have to make the argument that there is no just reason for war, for the violence in war, then by extension you have to make the same argument that there is no just reason to use violence to defend yourself. And by the same, and extending that still further, you have to use the same kind of argument to justify why you cannot defend people who are defenseless. It's the same reasoning. So if a person broke into your house, I'll just talk to the men here for a moment. If somebody broke into your house and they began to assault your spouse or your children, doing horrible things to them, and you said, please don't do that. You know, what you're doing really offends me. I mean, really, you're debasing yourself by doing those kinds of things to these people that I love. Please don't do that. How effective do you think that might be? It's probably not going to be very effective. Let me ask you this question. If your child or children knew that under no circumstances would you ever defend them, what would be the possibility that they could ever grow up emotionally healthy in your home? It just doesn't make sense. So I think because of arguments like that, Augustine came up with what was called just war theory. And basically it just means these four or five things. Number one, there must be a just cause. It is commonly held that aggressive war is only permissible if its purpose is to retaliate against a wrong already committed or to preempt an anticipated attack. So number one says you must possess a just cause. It is commonly held that aggressive war is only permissible if its purpose is to retaliate against a wrong already committed, to pursue and punish an aggressor, or to preempt an anticipated attack. So you can prevent more, the argument is you can prevent more bad from happening if you can cut off what's going to be bad sooner rather than later. Number two, the notion of proper authority. The notion of proper authority therefore requires thinking about what is meant by sovereignty, what is meant by the state, and what is the proper relationship between a people and its government. So, you and I can't say to Russia, you can't say, Ada can't send a letter to Russia saying, all right, Russia, we're going to war. She can do that, but she has no authority to do that. So there has to be a proper authority to say, we're going to respond in this kind of a way if you don't stop and desist from what it is that you're doing. Number three, the possession of right intention. A nation waging war should be doing so for the cause of justice and not for reasons of self-interest or aggrandizement. This is where we always get into trouble. When we say we're going to war for this reason, but there are these underlying reasons that are really more true than the reason for which we say we are going to war. A just war cannot be considered to be just if reasons of national interest are paramount or overwhelm the pretext of fighting aggression. This is where we hold our legislators accountable. Number four, reasonable success. What are the potential problems? What is the cost-benefit analysis? In other words, might it really be better just to negotiate terms of peace as opposed to going to war? Because the negotiation for the terms of peace might actually turn out better than if we went to war. Don't go to the aid or defend if there is no conceivable chance of success. For things like standing up to bullying nations, many nations throughout history have overcome enormous odds, so there are potential problems with reasonable success, and these are some of them. And number five, the desired end should be proportional to the means used. In other words, so if Canada decided that they were going to hack off a certain portion of the Great Lakes for themselves, we don't send a nuclear bomb to Quebec. It has to be proportionate to get them to stop and to desist. You can't overdo the defense. if a moderate amount of defense will do the trick. In other words, if somebody walks into my yard and I think they're going to attack me, it doesn't mean I have a right to be violent to them. I can simply say, get off my property, and that might be all that's necessary for them to get off my property. It has to be proportionate. So there's a view, kind of a view of the whole idea of just war theory and how it relates. And that just war theory has controlled, it has informed Western civilization for, like I said, 1,600 years. All of this is related to Memorial Day because the soldiers that have gone on before and who have sacrificed themselves, in principle, sacrificed themselves because those were the principles that were argued. And they did because they loved themselves, they loved their families, they loved this country, and they wanted to preserve what they believed in an overarching fashion was good and what was best for the world. And it's perfectly appropriate for Christians to honor that sacrifice in that kind of a way. But if they're going to sacrifice their lives in that kind of a way, maybe, just maybe, we will need fewer people to sacrifice themselves in the future if we as Christians did a better job being citizens of heaven and allowing that citizenship to inform how we should be citizens of earth. Maybe, just maybe, we can be more salt and more light, the kind of salt and the kind of light that reduces the need for any kind of violence, whether it's national, whether it's local. Maybe if we lived according to Romans chapter 12, verses 12 through 21, better, where love covers a multitude of sins, maybe we can make the world a better place in that way.